It is 7:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
I'm Antonia Juhas, and I'm here on time today.
The Bart gods were kind.
The Bart gods were kind to me.
Also with us, Mitch Jezeris.
Good morning, sir. Everybody. Good morning, Antonia.
Good morning, Mitch.
Good to see you again.
You too.
And hello, Brian. Nice to see you.
Oh, hey, guys.
Yes.
So, obviously, enormous news breaks overnight while most of us are sleeping. Donald Trump comes out of a summit in Singapore with some kind of agreement with Kim Jong-un. We have scheduled many very competent guests to go over what is and is not in that agreement and it might mean for the future. So we're not going to spend too much time on it right now. Big question, Antonia Juhas, what is the one sentence takeaway?
I'll take the one sentence from the head of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, who said about the summit, looked like more of a big welcome party to the nuclear cub for Korea than any denuclearization.
I'm sorry. I know we're just doing one sentence, but what does that mean?
What does that mean? It means that there was so much good in it for North Korea and so little in actual commitments. This is one of those cases where looking beyond the headlines is really the way to go into the details of what was and, more importantly, what was not in the agreement, that all the pomp and circumstance and all of the, I mean, Trump went on about his love for the North Korean leader, and continuing his what seems to be continual comfort and preference for dictators, praised Kim Jong-un, and then walked away without really anything solid in commitments, except for a lot of frothy language on denuclearization. And so what the head of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons was saying was having that nuclear arsenal is what got this meeting, and nothing in that meeting is going to make that nuclear arsenal go away.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did Trump say pledge to denuclearize as well?
You know, somehow
no,
that wasn't
not.
In
yes.
in the language. No,
yeah.
no denuclearization for the United States. But we will spend an amazing half an hour coming up at 7:30 on this summit with two incredible expert women as our guests. And it's going to be a fantastic discussion about what didn't happen in the summit. But more importantly, what is it that North and South Koreans want on the peninsula, and how? What is the path towards peace and denuclearization?
Yeah. And I would hazard a guess that Christine Hong is going to have a sunnier take on the outcome of those talks than the International Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. That should be a very interesting discussion. But we also try to use the space to recap the important news that happens that gets drowned out by whatever emerges from the Twitter Trump of our, the Twitter account of our president.
The Twitter Trump. I like it.
Twitter Trump. Two really big pieces in news today I wanted to make sure we hit on. We did not have time to find guests for them because we were scrambling to figure out what to do about North Korea. One of them is on the immigration front. And this is a ruling that comes out of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who actually has the power to take any immigration case that is in the immigration courts, refer it to himself, become the judge, the final legal authority, and basically set precedent and policy for all the other immigration judges. So he was handling a case that he had referred to himself. And this self-referral, by the way, is a mechanism that he has used much more liberally than attorneys general past. In which he was hearing the case of someone who was seeking asylum. And he issues a ruling that reads in pertinent part as follows, quote, generally, claims by aliens pertaining to domestic violence or gang violence perpetrated by non-governmental actors will not qualify for asylum. This describes a lot of people who have come to the U.S. southern border seeking asylum from Central America in recent years. There is no disputing in many of their cases that they fear for their lives when they come here. Many of them fear for their lives because of gang activity, particularly in El Salvador. And many women recently have made the case that they fear for their lives because of domestic violence and the inability of their governments to protect them. This effectively means, it does not absolutely mean they will all be turned away, but it means they'll be presumptively turned away. And it also means that people who show up at the border and say, I have an asylum case, many more of them will not be given the benefit of the doubt and the chance to stay in the country while it works through the courts. And one immigrant in particular whose case we've been following periodically, Fernando Carrillo, we've interviewed him, we've interviewed his wife, Lourdes Barraza. He made national headlines when ICE detained him while he was dropping his daughter off at daycare. He won an initially favorable ruling from a judge. The details of his case he was not comfortable discussing in public because he thought it might put some people at risk. But what he strongly implied was that because a relative is involved with law enforcement in Mexico, if he went back, he might be subject to reprisal violence. Won that case in a San Francisco immigration court. Had it appealed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is in and of itself unusual, and is now waiting on the outcome of that case, this ruling by Jeff Sessions will make that much harder for him and everyone like him, if we're trying to think about what the actual real-world implications of this are.
I mean, this is, of course, is an extenuation of an incredibly punitive set of immigration policies that are designed with the clear intention of telling immigrants, refugees trying to come to the United States, you are utterly not welcome. And of course, another example of that is this policy of intentionally separating children from their parents at the border, parents coming in, families coming in Texas, and having their children sent to New York and being separated. And a father who had this happen to him recently committed suicide while being held in the United States. And on all the ways that this is horrendous policy, one of the things I took note of today in comparison to how U.S. law has operated in the past, today also happens to be the same day that the U.S. Supreme Court ended our laws prohibiting interracial marriage in 1967, moving in a very different direction, and a direction that most of us, all of us, I hope, are very, very happy about, compared to the direction of our legal system under this administration. And I thought that was important to bring up, in today's reflecting on today's events.
And I think you're right at looking at the story that Brian just laid out in its entirety, including this zero tolerance policy of charging everyone who comes across the border with a crime, hence separating them from their children. If they come with their children, there are news reports now about the courts down around the border just being packed every day with parents that are in this incredible, difficult situation. And that is, do I continue to try to push my case for asylum, which could take quite some time to happen, or do I just plead guilty now in order to speed up in order to get back to my kids, in order to be reunited?
Or in the hope of being reunited, because of course there isn't even necessarily a guarantee that you're going to be reunited, or how quickly, or what's going to happen to your child in the interim. I mean, the terror and fear is unimaginable.
I mean, this is like Sophie's Choice type of territory that we are talking about. And then couple that in with taking away legal protections for children who came here at a young age and grew up here, went to schools here, no other country than here, you know, the dreamers. Couple that in with the killing, the shooting in the head, a 20-year-old Guatemalan woman on the border just a few weeks ago. And you look at this in its entirety, and it is just an incredibly cruel policy that's going on right now that I think history will look back at this period of time, will look back on us as a country in a very damning way. And I think it's really important for society to always be aware of what's happening to the most vulnerable segments of its populations. It's almost like a canary in the coal mine. And I'm not trying to say that immigrants or even undocumented immigrants are helpless. I mean, they have a very strong movement going on, but of course they don't have all the same legal protections. They don't have all the same political protections. And I think we should be very aware always, not just this population, but every vulnerable population, about how they're treated in our society, because it's dangerous.
And hopefully it's not going to take history to reflect back. I think the outrage is strong and the commitment to changing policy is strong. The problem, one of the problems with this administration, among many, is that it acts quickly, even knowing that it is acting illegally, on the presumption that the fight will win it political points, and caring not at all about the lives literally lost in the balance. And that, of course, is where the movements of resistance come in and are coming in.
Yeah.
And can I just also add, I mean, since we're talking about the politics of it and something we've talked about before on this program, but I can update it, is on this discharge petition that's happening in sure. Congress and the House of Representatives. This is brought by Jeff Denham, a Republican from the outskirts of the Bay Area over in the Modesto area, Republican. A discharge petition is if you can get a majority of the members in the House of Representatives to sign on it, you can bring a bill that's been stuck in committee that basically the Republican leadership hasn't allowed to come to the floor for a vote or even to make its process through the committees to do so. And you need a majority of congressional members, 218 members, to be able to get that to happen. And he's doing this on immigration bills. And, of course, he's in a tough reelection bid this year. His district is more than 40% Latino, so it's an issue for him. It's an issue for a number of Republicans, actually, especially Republicans that have large, diverse communities that they represent.
Also fair to say, the large employers in his district are heavily reliant on immigrant labor.
Sure.
It's not necessarily that he's looking at Latinos as part of his base, but that there is a big section of the capitalist economy who would like many more workers.
But he's doing this right before an election mm-hmm. in which people are going to be voting.
Yeah, but those business interests are also interests that he's trying to serve right before his election, yeah. I would guess. I mean, combination of the two.
Yep.
Yeah. And so what happens here is he and others that are supporting this discharge petition, and almost all Democrats have now signed on to it. There were three holdouts, but now only one's holding out. And that one holdout is because they're worried that any kind of bill that this could bring a vote on would also include funding for a border wall on the Mexican-American border. But there are far more Democrats signing on this than Republicans. But there are enough Republicans to where they say, we have enough signatures. We're just waiting to try to see if we can work out some type of deal with Paul Ryan. And their original deadline for this was last Thursday. And they didn't make it, but they said, we're going to continue talking about this during the weekend. We're going to continue negotiating. Today is actually a procedural deadline. If they want this discharge petition to move this month, it would have to happen by today. If it doesn't happen by today, they have one more chance next month to make it. But if they don't make it by the end of next month, then the whole issue is off the table for the rest of the year. And look, let's just say they were to get the discharge petition or make some type of a deal. It would be you may not even like the bill, right? You may not even like the final bill that could potentially be voted on, could come out of the House of Representatives. No guarantee it's going to come out of the Senate. But I think what this is indicative of, and when we talk about the cruel, really cruel policies that are coming from the administration concerning immigration, is what we're seeing in the House right now is they're not able to get the House leadership to move on immigration. They haven't been able to get the House leadership to move on immigration. These are centrist, Republican centrists that are trying to push this forward. That was, you know, before, there wasn't that long ago when most people were like, yeah, we should protect Dreamers, you know, that, mm-hmm. that had bipartisan support. But what we're seeing is this inability to move something is the power that the Freedom Caucus now has and how proceedings occur in the House of Representatives, which I think would argue, and this is a good example of it, that they have more power than the, you know, so-called centrist Republicans on what comes to the floor in the House and what does not. And to me, this is very much in line with a realignment of what is happening with the Republican Party.
But the interesting there is that the Freedom Caucus would be hardliners on immigration. I mean, these are people who rode a wave that was largely financed by the Koch brothers, whose politics are more libertarian. They do not particularly seem to care about keeping immigrants out of the country so much as keeping them from voting.
Yeah, I think it's generous to call it libertarian, by the way. I think they ride on the quote-unquote libertarian coattails. Mm-hmm. I think it's less a policy of genuine belief in libertarianism and more a policy of pure how can we make the most money from the operations that we have and have the party in place and the decision-makers in place that will help us do that, have the market that we want to help us do that, and we'll paint it in libertarianism to make it sound better than greed and opportunism.
Because most libertarians are not anti-immigration. would push for.
Right, that's my point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, many libertarians are for open borders, yeah. So.
One more court case we should hit on in the few minutes we have left. The biggest voting rights case that was in front of the Supreme Court this session got decided yesterday, Husted versus A. Philip Randolph. And this was determining the outcome of a challenge to the way the state of Ohio purges voters from its polls, from its rolls, rather, which is similar to how seven other states are set up to do it, and more Republican-controlled states probably will in the future, because the Supreme Court came down on the side of Ohio. And the issue here is a law that is not the Voting Rights Act. It is the Voter Registration Act. You may remember this if you are one of the 4 million people who bought REM's album Out of Time, because on the back of the long box case, they printed a cutout postcard that you could mail to your representatives asking for passage of the precursor version of this bill. It was called the Motor Voter Registration Act. It was meant to make it a lot easier to register to vote, but also a lot harder to lose the right to vote once you had registered. And one of the things it prohibits is taking people off the rolls exclusively because they have not voted in recent elections. Ohio came up with a very tiny workaround. After you have not voted for 2 years, they send you a postcard. The postcard says, hey, your registration's in question because you haven't voted. And then if you don't respond to it or vote for the next 4 years, they take you off the roll. Empirically, this seems to affect African-Americans much more than white people in Ohio, particularly in the urban counties. But the legal challenge was not over the discriminatory impact of the law. It was whether it specifically violated that technical provision saying you can't take people off for not voting. And on that basis, the Supreme Court said in a narrow 5-4 decision, looks good to me. So the kind of open legal question is, if voting rights groups, if the ACLU decides to challenge the same laws on grounds of discriminatory impact and possibly discriminatory intent, who knows what record they'll be able to put together about the deliberations, would they flip any of the justices who were in that 5-vote majority? And if not, you might see, you know, a lot of people who are only motivated to vote when there's a lot of national attention on election, when there's a really strong voter mobilization push, when there are lots of door knockers, the way you saw around, you know, the first Barack Obama campaign, go to the polls in the next presidential election and find out that they have lost the right to vote without even really being aware of it.
Absolutely.
That's how it happens.
And of course, lost in who does is unreached through a postcard campaign. You don't have to have a home to be able to vote. And so only being reached by a postcard is certainly not a mechanism that's going to help people who are homeless or who have switched homes recently or can't get to their home to get their postcard is not a valid way of reaching people. So as you say, unless you're involved in an active campaign that's really reaching out to everyone to make sure they know how to vote, when to vote, how to stay registered, this is a really good mechanism of keeping anyone who is even slightly marginalized away from the polls.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think of how the country is splitting into contrasts on this particular issue. Like the election we just went through in California, for the first time we were allowed to do same-day voter registration.
That's right.
Right? Show up and register. If you weren't registered before, not a problem. Which, when you think about it, is like, why didn't we do that before? Like, why do we make it hard for people to vote? The state's rolling out a program whereby eventually it seems like all parts of the state are going to mail everybody a vote by mail ballot that they can send in ahead of time if they want to, so they don't have to go to the polls and work their way through a phone book sized ballot in the booth. And then you have this other half of the country that's basically doing everything it can to throw up obstacles to voting in hopes that it's going to be a hardcore conservative base that still turns out.
Well, and one of the things that was recently exposed by analysis by OpenSecrets.org was a $1 million payment that went to the Trump inaugural committee from a shell company that was hiding that the actual source of the funds was one of the most conservative, pro-conservative judge groups in the country. Hmm. And that this, and that they succeeded in having the Trump administration push some of their very select judges across the country, select super conservative judges across the country, potentially quid pro quo, and the wave of conservative rulings could be even worse in the future if these are the type of judges that the Trump administration is going to continue to put in, and if it's doing so as a result of potentially payments from conservative groups. That's certainly something for the ACLU to look at, hopefully.
Well, that takes us to 7:30 in the morning. The program is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
I'm Antonia Juhas.
Antonia, what do we got coming up?
We have an amazing discussion about the North Korea summit that just concluded. Was it a historic agreement to bring denuclearization, or was it a bunch of pomp and circumstance that's going to make peace harder to achieve? Our guests are Mairead McGuire, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and University of Santa Cruz Associate Professor Christine Hong.
That's all next after the news.